All right, so I gather almost everybody at this point is sort of terminally confused.
Absolutely.
Good!
I don't even know where to start.
My only frustration with the fact that you guys are terminally confused is that Hopkins students ought to be too smart to get terminally confused on Saturday when a hard assignment has been getting hinted at for 3 weeks. Or perhaps they're not. I'd expect it better. The problem with this stuff is you can talk it through until you're blue in the face, but until somebody's actually faced with the tools in their hands and trying to make them work, it's very hard to make any sense out of it, right? So there wasn't really any point trying to do that. And what I sort of wanted was for you guys to dive in, get stuck, push a little bit, and then at least come up with a set of questions. So what I want to do today is I want to take the first half and try once again to dig into the kernel invocation path. And then in the back half, try to let you guys drive and answer questions about how to get stuff built. My impression is that most of what is baffling people amounts to, you know, how does the build system work? How does all this stuff fit together? Where are the various tools? I learned, unfortunately, today that the usage message in capital is stale, which surely didn't help anybody. Things like this, but at least now we'll have a set of questions to react to and find out where people are actually struggling and where they're not. It's very hard to predict that from where I sit, right? I don't know what things people are going to find confusing and whatnot. I want to start the cross-process invocation discussion over because I started it in the wrong way. Where I should have started it was with a picture. So the scenario here is we have a process A and a process B. B is acting as the service. And I try to avoid the use of the word server because server conjures up a notion that the server is not in turn a client of something else. And I very explicitly want to have the notion that the server might be a client of something else. There's also a problem in the picture of client-server that there's an assumption somehow that A calls B, B calls C, C returns to B, B returns to A, and we're done, and that it's all very sort of stack-like in this way. And that's certainly commonly the case, but it's not universally the case. Okay. So what's going on is, let's do the cross-process case first. A is trying to invoke B. A is holding an entry capability register. That entry capability, we hope, points to an endpoint. Endpoint, in turn, contains a process capability to B, and we hope that B is receiving, although that may not be the case. Now, fortunately, the statement that I just gave about what these capabilities are is certainly the one that we hope is the case. That's weird. Your password gets wired into your fingers, but you still can't type it correctly if you're talking at the same time. It's very bizarre, right? When you think of all of the motions that you do on a keyboard, that needs to be hardwired after a while, especially if you've been using the password as long as I have. I keep getting told that changing my password will improve security. Anybody who does the least bit of thinking about statistics will conclude this is hopelessly bullshit. There is absolutely no reason to believe that your guess at my password is any closer or further away tomorrow than it was yesterday. Until the password is actually compromised. Alright, so the story that the kernel has no reason to believe that this is what's going on. So every step of this story has to be checked. And then furthermore, there's some modes in how the invoker is invoking, there's some modes in how the receiver is receiving, and then there's the payload arrangements that the two sides have made. So we got to deal with all of that, regrettably. And let's see, let's think about how to do this.
see if that still works.
Yes, that still works. For a wonder. That works.
What I'm trying to trace down here is what happened to current process. We'll see if we can. What the heck?
Wrong.
Right, if you open the wrong file, you don't get the content you were expecting. Isn't that amazing? If you haven't figured it out, this code is like way too long to be happy with.
All right, so trying to get down the kernel path first, although there are common elements. And some of the what's going on in the implementation of the cross-process path is not going to be motivated until we look at the in kernel path. What's going on is that there's some parts of what's done that you sort of like to handle them with common logic, even though one path doesn't really need them, mainly because the logic is complicated enough that you'd like to not do it twice. So on the x86, you may have noticed that we have a dearth of registers. That is not enough. So what's happening on the x86 is that there's a so-called parameter block. And the parameter block is pointed to on entry into the kernel by, I believe it's pointed to by the stack pointers, either the stack pointer or the base pointers. So I'm hoping which one it is. This is a horrible hack. Okay? So what's going on is that some of the parameters in the kernel are being conveyed in registers. Some of them are being conveyed off of the stack, although you should hear stack here in quotation marks because I'm going to show you a dirty trick we're playing in a second. On the way out, some of the outgoing parameters are going to go in registers, and some of them are going to get copied out to the receiver stack. Okay? So if you want to see what's going on the stack frame, then you want to look at this file syscall.h. Let us see if I can compel this silly thing to give me that. Syscall lives in syscall.h here. Perhaps may not have been included. Oh, wait a minute, there we go. Also the case that if you don't actually hit the mouse pad, the mouse doesn't move. Another one of the brilliant insights you get when you work laptops long enough. So there's a duality of perspective on what's going on the stack here. Okay? From the application perspective, at this point, hopefully, you've had occasion to want to poke into one of those ugly .h's that capital generates, okay? And you'll notice that it's using this syscall structure down here. This is a convenient way to get the right frame built on the stack, and it helps us ensure that the code that's generated by capital will work correctly on all platforms, because by expressing what the frame looks like using C code, we can get C to help us deal with things like alignment, byte order, and padding. However, this is not the way the kernel looks at it. Okay? The kernel is going to look at this as a sequence of words that have been pushed onto the stack. I'm not actually convinced in hindsight that that was the right way to go about this. The rationale is that I didn't want to have to import into the kernel structures for half a billion types of parameters where the structures were going to differ according to the target platform. Again, not sure that was the right call. There is a method to the madness. So if you look at what's going on in this parameter block, parameter block on the stack has space for up to 8 words. These are the so-called register parameters, although in the x86 they don't all go in registers. It then has specifiers for 4 send capabilities and 4 receive capabilities. And then it has some parameters that tell you something about the so-called indirect string. Now, if you look at what capital is generating, you'll discover that capital generates some variation on this structure. The variation generally meaning that more of the names get expanded to match the parameters that you put in your procedure call. And if it builds an indirect string at all, it actually builds it by abutting it to the end of the structure. So in practice, that send pointer string always points later into the structure if the structure was generated by capital. It's not a requirement of the kernel-level interface. In fact, it's a problem because there are a couple of different process models. One is the small process. Small process only has 1 page worth of stack. There are cases where capital generates structures that are too big to fit on that stack. One of them, unfortunately, is the stack frame for kprintf. So, if you've been using Text Console as a model for how to build a constructed process, you probably copied the MKI file and fiddled it. If you did that, one of the things you got when you copied it was a line in there that read image.load underscore small. Get rid of that, change it to image.load underscore elf. Load small is basically saying, I would like to build a process image that's going to run with a very peculiar layout of the stack and data that is designed not to need any kind of fault handling services at all. The reason you might want to run a process this way is because you need to manipulate your address space in certain ways that do not apply to you. Change that to load elf. It will help resolve a lot of mysteries you may or may not have hit yet. Okay. So among those parameter words at the top, the very first one is known as the invocation control word. If this is an invoke capability call, we're going to be setting up this kind of structure. If it's one of the other system calls, we're still going to use a register-based interface, and that register-based interface has some things in common with this structure, which is not entirely by accident. But portions of this structure may not be populated. So there, you can send up to four capabilities, but if the control word says, I'm not sending capabilities, the kernel will not look at those locations in this structure. So this structure says, here's the layout of what the stack frame has to be, but it does not state a contract about which fields are expected to be populated. That's the business of the control word. So the kernel's going to have to grind through this to figure out what arguments you're sending, what you're invoking, et cetera, et cetera. So up above, you'll see there's this documentation that says, if I'm looking from the kernel perspective, or if I'm building one of these frames in assembly language, where are these words going to appear relative to the stack pointer? So this is the word-wise view of that same data structure, which is how the kernel's going to look at it, and also how low-level assembly code looks at it. Another piece of information, which is, I don't think, documented in this file, though it's documented elsewhere. The kernel specification, the kernel interface specification, requires that at least the first two parameter words have to go in hardware registers. So capital currently is not well optimized. What it's doing is it's populating this structure, and it hands off a pointer to the structure to a generic system call library routine, which reaches in, loads the values back out of the structure into the registers, and executes the kernel trap. Notice that, since the contract requires that the first two parameters go in registers, follows that the first two slots of the structure are available for other uses at the moment of the trap. Why do the first two words need to go in registers? Well, the very first word is the control word, right? It would be really bad not to have ready to hand the word that tells us how to interpret this structure. And the second word is mostly useful because it tells us, what's in the second word in the system call case? I don't remember offhand. Why is it important that the first two slots are in? Well, on the x86, we're really short of registers. So if we were to dig into this and go look at the bottom-level system call stub, what we would see is a system call stub takes a pointer to this structure, and it carefully squirrels, it loads the first word to one side, into the register that it has to be in and system call enter. Having done so, it stores your current stack pointer into the first word of this structure, and then makes the current stack pointer point to this structure. This is a disgusting low-level system tagger trick, and that's being played at. Why? Well, it turns out when we enter the kernel, the hardware will do a little bit of help for us, but not very much. And one of the things that it will do is it will reload the stack segment register, and it turns out that references by way of the stack pointer are implicitly done by way of the stack segment register, and this means that we can make references into this data structure from very early in the kernel path in order to validate it. And that's why the stack pointer or the base pointer were the two possible choices here. This is a lot of detail about the penning you don't need, except to explain that there are dirty tricks going on in the structure. by the time the kernel gets the picture, some of these words are in registers, and the reason the kernel looks at this word-wise is when it's looking for a particular word in the structure, it has to be able to know whether that word should actually come from the structure or whether that word should instead come from a well-known register that's defined in the architecture-specific specification. That's why the kernel looks at it word-wise. It might seem like that's an inordinate amount of work, and on the Pentium, it surely is. On other architectures, much more of this structure would end up in registers, perhaps even all of it, and we would do away with the structure altogether. And there will be future versions of the capital backend that will actually generate the registerizing version directly. They will not go through the general purpose system call stuff. So you'll see things like get ICW, right? This is a short inline procedure that says, in an architecture-specific way, go figure out how to fetch the word that is the invocation control word and get that value back for me. And it turns out that word is required to be registerized on all architectures. What's it matter whether it's registerized or not? Things that are registerized have the property that you can't change them out from under us. Because in order for you to alter the register set of a process that is currently invoking a system call, you would have to execute a set registers kernel operation on it. The parameters that are in memory, regrettably, do not have that property, and we have to be careful about how many times we access them. In particular, we have to assume that there may be a second thread out there that is fiddling those parameters, or attempting to get a use after check error to occur. So for example, we're going to bounce check the string pointer to make sure it's within the legal user accessible range. The assumption is that you're out there trying to change the pointer just after we execute the bounce check to force us to do a copy from kernel memory. So there are security constraints anytime a kernel is taking parameters that are supplied by user code, and especially so when those parameters include pointers, and those pointers are stored in memory. And it's very likely, by the way, that this path still has bug catchers. Okay. So, what are the phases of a system call here, of the invoke system call? There's a send phase, there's a receive phase, and there's a copy out phase. The copy-out phase only exists because of the benighted Pentium. The problem here is we have more words of output than will fit in registers, and so at some point we have to transfer them back to recipient memory. That's what the copy-out phase does. One strategy for doing that would be to simply copy those words across into the other address space, along with the rest of the payload. There are a variety of reasons why it's inconvenient to do that, but the big one is, it turns out most of those parameters overwrite things that are received parameters. So one of the things that you're going to tell me when you come into the kernel with an invocation, you're going to tell me, where do I want the output string to go and how many bytes am I willing to take? Those are parameters that when I'm sending you a message, that is, when I'm in the kernel path that's executing for me because I said send a message in this capability, right? The kernel needs to go look at that parameter that you previously supplied. And we do not want to have to reach into your address space to do it. Because to do that, we would have to cross-map your pages. Now, cross-mapping your pages is a bit expensive. Unmapping the pages afterwards is even more expensive. And if we fail to do that, we can end up in a situation where the system call does not complete all the way through, and we leave a dangling reference in your memory that's live in the TLB, and now the sender goes someplace else, and bingo, they can overwrite your memory. So there's some delicacy here. All the parameters that control where the incoming payload is going to go, the way this works is that they're presented in the parameter block on the way in, and the kernel makes a temporary copy of them into your process state. So when I start my invocation, those parameters get copied in. Later, when you send to me, the kernel makes reference to the ones that have already been copied into my process state inside the kernel. It does not make reference to the ones on my stack. This is solely to avoid a cross-process mapping, which can be a couple hundred cycles. A couple hundred cycles, if you run Java code, is not a big deal. That's the cost of one bytecode. But in a system call, in a cross-process system call in a microkernel, a couple hundred cycles is the end of the world. That's longer than we want the total end-to-end typical case to take. So there are performance tricks here, right? And unfortunately, this is not the class of stuff that optimizers can deal with, because they involve making decisions about data structures and explicit data placement in order to get performance out. We're not only concerned with which things do we have to copy so we do not have to do a cross-process reference, we're also concerned about what's the actual data layout of those things so that we minimize the number of cache line fetches that are going to be used to access them. I think it's fair to say that that microkernel people are the last of the micro-optimizers in our field. Okay. Now, great, so the invocation control word is in registers, and that's nice because it means that I can fetch it to determine what system call is happening before I know anything about the parameter block. I don't have to go and validate any addresses to do that. Oh, the reason the second word is in a register is the other system calls can all be expressed in two words, and so they don't have a parameter block at all. Fortunately, if I've gotten this far, I know I'm doing an invoke capability system call, that means I've got to validate the parameter block. The problem is, what I know is that you allege that your stack pointer points at a parameter block. I don't know that it does. I don't know if it does that the parameter block is well formed. But I don't even know that the parameter block is something in an area of the address space that you should legally be able to read. It's something I need to know. Now, at this point, what I'm doing is a range check on the base address and the bound address of the parameter block. I'm making sure that every byte in the parameter block falls outside of the kernel portion of the virtual address space. This does not guarantee that the parameter block is validly mapped. In fact, we checked that. Remember where we do that. Okay, I do not remember whether that's done here. I think this is just doing range. Yeah, I'm sure this is just doing range checking. All right. Suppose I wanted to make sure that there were actually legally mapped pages at that parameter block address. How might I go about it? If the check if the page table structures come to that address. Yes, indeed, that's what I need to do, and I need to do an access check, although if they're valid, they're readable, because that's the way the page table hardware tends to be designed. So how am I going to go about doing that check? I walk into GPTs. That's about the most expensive way imaginable. That would work, absolutely. And if we were taking the view that this was a reference implementation that I wanted my competitors to use to compete with me, that would be the right implementation. The problem with open source is that people then supply better implementations and everybody gets to use them. This is also the benefit of open source, but you know, you sort of got to play to win, right? Okay, so what would be the next worst implementation I could use? Skipped one! Absolutely right. I mean, the next worst implementation I could use is I could actually go look at the page tables. Indeed, the right thing to do is to simply just issue a read to the start and the end address to verify that I can read both of those addresses. And why both of them? Why do I need to look at both the first and the last byte to validate the region? The structure, right? Where is the structure in memory? What's going to determine whether one of those reads succeeds? I'm going to issue a read, I'm going to read a byte. What's going to determine, in fact, I'm going to read a word. What's going to determine whether that read succeeds? I have a sufficiently buggy kernel, the read will succeed. I'd like to rule that one out, but perhaps that would be optimistic. What's going to determine whether that read succeeds? I'm sure you know, and I want somebody else to jump in here.
If it's somehow mapped.
It's mapped. I mean, if it's mapped, then it's valid. Right?
Right.
So if I read the first byte of the structure, or the first word, and actually the structure is in practice word aligned, do I know the entire structure is valid? How much of the structure do I know is valid at that point? First word. What about the second word? How do I not know that's valid?
You could have put it right at the end of your address.
Could cross a page boundary. So how many words do I actually have to hit to know that the entire structure is valid? Want to think of it that way, how many bytes? Either way, it's fine. Yeah. Why is start and end enough? That's correct, but why is that enough?
Because it's linear.
Right, so linear sequence, but what else?
That is not as big as a page.
We know the structure size is less than a page. So it may be more than one page, but it won't be more than two pages. Right? If the structure size were potentially larger than a page, we basically have to hit, we have to guarantee that we hit every page that might be behind the structure. Okay, so if I want to do the probe, you know, in the rigorous upfront way, I issue the read at every page offset. Now, what would happen if I did that and the area wasn't mapped? This is an invalid region. What happens if I read the invalid region? You shot that? What happens if I issue a read to an invalid address in general? Page fault. Page fault. Right? Now, What happens when my kernel takes to page fault? What's that?
Presumably it invokes the page fault handler.
If you, right, I get two choices, right? I'm either going to invoke the page fault handler or the BIOS advertising agent. Right? Yes. Okay. It invokes the page fault handler. Now, in this case, you may have, in fact, some of you have already hit the case where the kernel gripes and whines, because gripes is not the first one I was thinking about using, that it has taken a page fault at a user mode address. So it turns out I don't think we actually probe those addresses. And the reason we don't probe those addresses is we're going to read them and treat them as read-only. We're going to have read all of them before we do anything interesting. So the kernel is actually very careful to ensure that at any point where the kernel might take a page fault accessing a user mode address, that it can simply issue the page fault to the process and abandon the system call. Now this is tricky, okay? Because what's going to happen here is, here's the line between user and supervisor mode. And we don't really know where the user's real stack user's real stack is, you know, off in La La Land somewhere. The user stack pointer points to the parameter block. And we've entered the kernel, and we're somewhere down in the kernel stack in this do syscall, or actually in the capability procedure. It took a page fault. Got two traps deep into the kernel. We're actually going to process the page fault at this point. No. If this is a kernel fault, that is a reference to a user mode address that was made by the kernel, what's going to happen is we're going to mark the current process as having taken a page fault at that address, and we're then going to abandon the transaction. Abandoning the transaction here does not mean we're going to return from the page fault. Abandoning the transaction here means we're going to abandon the entire kernel stack. We're going to go all the way back up to here. This is a throw that crosses the exception boundary for the page fault. This is only reasonable because the kernel takes great care to make sure that we'll never get in trouble doing this. One of the reasons that these little accessor procedures exist is to guarantee that we cannot be in a place where the optimizer could be moving things around on us in the wrong ways.
Right.
So this valid param block thing was not as innocent as it looked. In fact, I think we're probably probing. What? We have to do the range check anyway. Because suppose that you set the stack pointer to point to the 3 GB boundary. Well, that region is readable with the kernel. It will not fault because the kernel has marked, well, actually, 3 GB plus 1 MB, which would be the first few bytes of the kernel code. Right? That's a legal kernel region, but you're not allowed to reference it. The problem is we're doing the reference in supervisor mode, so we actually have to do the bounce check. By the way, we have to check high and low, because if we were to check only high, we'd say, oh, well, I'll start it at the very top of memory and I'll let it wrap around so that the high part works. Okay. Now, if we did the probe in here, notice that we've already issued the page fault and valid param block will not return in that case. The scenario in which valid param block returns is that the entire range was legally mapped for the supervisor. And then it returns true or false according to whether it was legally mapped for user mode access.
What happens if it crosses the page boundary into another processing scheme?
You can't do that because all these references are being done. Good question. All these references are being done in the translation context of the invoking process. In order for that to happen, somehow we would have to have set up a mapping in your address space that points to somebody else. And by construction, we're going to avoid doing that in general.
You could just say, all right, my parameter block is at end of my address space.
Sure. No, but there is no end of your address space. Your address space is your address space. Right?
It's for that process.
Right?
Only the page.
This is a virtual address, not a physical address.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah.
Anybody else understand what the question was? All right, so if we make it back from this thing, but the answer is it wasn't in the user mode range, this is a malformed system call, and we are not going to attempt to deal with it any further. So the thing I want to get across here is there's sort of a basic principle of operation in coding this kind of path, right? If the user can screw with you, they will. And You have to check any possible way that they might do that. On a multiprocessor, it's even more entertaining because you cannot assume that if you fetched an answer from memory a second ago, you will get the same answer this time. There's a sleeping body. There's a body buried here. The body that's buried here is, in fact, one of the things that the thread might do is change the mapping structures. So you really might go to do a reference that fails. That's a little tricky, and there's sort of a fundamental race there. And what we have to do, so the first question is what ought to happen, and then the second question is how do we make sure that happens? So suppose I've invoked a system call, and then some other party is messing with my address space while the system call is in progress. What should happen? What should not happen? First, what should not happen? Is that allowed?
The system call proceeds anyway.
The theory is that it should not happen, that the system call should proceed anyway with modified parameters. Is that correct? Does it matter if the parameters are modified, or does it matter if they're modified in a particular way? A simple way out would be to say, look, if I'm in the middle of a system call, don't let somebody mess around with my address space. That turns out to be astoundingly expensive to implement. So we have to rule that one out. That would certainly be the clean answer, and it would give us the most consistent story about the sequencing of system calls. Why is that particularly expensive? Because there's a very large number of data structures I have to lock in order to guarantee that that's the case, which is roughly all the data structures that describe the address space. Turns out, there's a answer that is a little simpler to implement. It has to be done with care. It has an unfortunate problem. The answer is, you don't really care if the parameters are modified before you read them, you being the kernel. What you care about is that once you check them for validity, you use the ones that you checked. If I want to make scrambled eggs out of my parameters, and the instant before you check them, hey, I'm an idiot, but that's on me, right? I have the God-given right to be an idiot. It's one of those things that goes with being faculty. You have a right to do that. Some of us indulge more than others. I indulge a lot. Okay. So the catch here is the time of check to time of use issue. Right? This is sort of a well-known security issue. You check something, I move it, you use it. Oops. The answer is, copy the parameter first. If you make a private copy of the parameter and then check the private copy, guess what? I can't mess with that one. That almost works. That's still got a hairball in it because some of those parameters are pointers into your data space. And you could change the definition of the data space out from under the operation. So we have to watch out for that. But for the most part, the answer is, copy the parameters first. So this save soft parameters, what that's actually doing is taking any of the parameters that I might need later that are not in registers, because the ones in registers you can't dork with without me catching it. Anything that's coming from memory, I'm saving it to a side structure. Now, why only if I'm doing a send phase or a receive phase? Well, the soft parameters actually mostly describe what's going to happen during the receive phase. So I might have an application that is not executing a send phase. I have to save them in either case. The application is only doing the copy out. It's reached the phase where it's using these parameters that have previously been saved. Now I'm going to copy the rest of the parameters, right? So that got the ones that I'm going to use on the receive side, but I still have some parameters sitting in memory. Could turn out to be no good. Could be fiddled out from under. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create this INV param structure. I'm going to zero it, and I'm immediately going to start putting stuff in it. I'll talk in a minute about what stuff. I don't have that open. Okay, so what's in the INV param structure? Well, you may notice some similarities between this and the one in syscall. Right, this is the kernel's copy. Now, it's not going to copy everything. Why not? First, kernel actually mostly doesn't have to copy the parameter words. Because the parameter words, if I'm doing the cross-process case, I'm just going to copy the words. I'm not going to interpret them. As long as I'm not going to interpret them, I don't really care if you fiddle them. And if I'm going to invoke a kernel capability, I don't yet know what the parameter words mean. I don't know if I want a 32-bit value or a 64-bit value. There's no point trying to stabilize them here. I don't have enough information to do that correctly yet. In the in-kernel case, I'm going to copy them. But in the cross-process case, I'm not going to bother. And From the kernel perspective, I'm not really much interested in the address of the capability that you said that you wanted to manipulate. I'm interested in the actual pointer to that capability. Right. You're going to specify an offset relative to your address. That's really an index into a data structure. What I have to do is go actually find the capability data structure corresponding to that address. I'm interested in the pointer to the capability structure from the perspective of the kernel's mapping on the world, not from your perspective. Go ahead, yeah.
The structure, you have the invoker and the invokee.
Yes.
That would be A and B.
Yes, so A in this example is the invoker, B is the invokee.
Okay, so that form in a sense to have invokee directly available at the endpoint?
Directly available to him. This is the kernel, right? The kernel, so the answer is I'm going to walk through the endpoint to figure out who the invokee is, but once I've got that party, I'm going to grab a lock in them and I want to hold on to a pointer to them for the duration of the current operation.
Right.
So most of what's here is the kernel's perspective on the parameters. And then simply to avoid passing extra parameters to every capability implementation, we're also going to cache the invoker and the invokee in this story. Also the endpoint. So invokee EP is the endpoint that points to the invokee. We're also going to cache input parameter word 0. Right? Notice these are OPW. These are the ones that are going out. Why store the output parameter words and not the input parameter? If we're in the cross-process case, I don't even think we use the output parameter words. I haven't think about that. We may, but that's probably a failure of optimization that we do or not. Why would we not? Well, oh yeah, yeah, we do. Okay. So in the cross-process case, what's going to happen is I have some input parameter words coming in. I'm going to copy those into the output parameter words here, and then I'm going to stuff them into locations in the receiving process because I want the receiving process to copy them out on its own dime. I'll already be running in the recipient address space when I do the copying. Why? Because some of those values getting copied out on some machines have to go into the parameter block, and I don't want to do that with a cross-space operation. We're only talking about a couple of words. It's cheaper to add a couple of words to the process structure as a holding buffer and then let the receiver copy them out after I've already had to do the address space switch than it is to do a cross-space mapping. If I do a cross-space mapping, I end up having to do an extra address space switch to undo the mapping. So I'm working like crazy to avoid doing any cross-space mapping that I might have to clean up if something goes wrong. At some threshold, the strategy ceases to work. If that were 40 words, we could have an argument about whether it was the right thing to cache them. Actually, at 40, the answer is probably still yes, surprisingly. Because unmapped is really pricey. See another question? Okay. Why not the input words? Well, if I'm copying them across, or I'm going to fetch them one word at a time, copying the output word, fetch them one word at a time, copying them to the output word, notice I'm not copying them yet to the target process. I'm copying them to a temporary kernel data structure. This happens before the commit point. If I take a sender page fault accessing those words out of the parameter block, that's okay. I'll just back the whole system call out as if it never happened, and I will throw away this temporary structure, right? The rule is, you can't modify externally observable state. But go ahead and build temporary structure out of the commit point. I'm relying, so notice what I get to evade here is doing explicit checks on the mapping state of the sender. I let the references themselves act as the probe, right? And then I design the kernel so that I can take the second layer page fault and recover it. If you try to do this in a monolithic kernel, right, they have special rooms with padded walls for the state that people go into when they try to engineer that. It's just too complicated as the thing scales up. Okay. I'm going to want to know what's the opcode. That's the second word. And I'm going to want to know what was the input parameter word. Those I do want to cache. And the reason I want to cache them is I'm going to make reference to them multiple times. And fetching them out of the process structure is relatively expensive. So what I'm after by copying these is I'm after cache alignment. Next IDW and next ODW we'll see shortly, but basically next IDW is basically a pointer into the input parameter words to say if I'm looking for the next word, what's the next one to grab? And similarly, the output says if I'm writing words out, what's the next one to write? The issue there is if I have a 64-bit parameter, what 32-bit boundary it's at depends on what target architecture I'm on. There are alignment issues that have to be dealt with. And we'll see that at some point when we look at an example capability implementation. Okay, so here, all we know so far is the invoker. We don't even know what capability we're invoking. We're provisionally going to build up more state as we go until we're ready to sort of say, okay, good, now we know what we're doing. So, more mode bits than a human should be allowed. Are we doing a send phase? Let's prop Marshall source that. So, I, the user, the invoker, specified either a register number or an address relative to my address space of the capability I'm trying to invoke. What the kernel needs is the kernel mode address that points to the actual capability slot in the actual object. This is not necessarily a trivial thing to find. I mean, if it's a register and you're invoking me on the kernel, I already know the process is in memory. If this is a memory address, I don't even know that the target page is in memory. I'm going to have to do a memory walk to determine that. So if you go dig into the Marshall code for Marshall SourceCap, what you'll discover is it decodes the mode bit to determine if this is a memory reference. And if it's a memory reference, it actually runs the address translator to determine whether that address is valid and whether the target page is in memory. That exercise, right, it's going to come to a GPT capability. We don't know if that GPT is in memory. How are we going to find out? We're going to prepare the capability. As a side effect, that will hopefully, that will either force the capability to come into memory and get locked, or it will cause us to discover that the capability that we've prepared is no good, in which case we will abandon, or it will cause us to initiate an IO, in which case we'll go on a stall queue and we'll move on to the next process. All of these things, well, several of these, except for the, yes, everything's in memory and it's already there and I fully succeeded case, right? There's several scenarios there where the attempt to prepare that path to the memory of the memory address could fail in the sense that some resource I need isn't present or some part of the path is malformed. And in any of those cases, I'm going to abandon this transaction. It's okay to abandon this transaction because I haven't changed any observable state yet. That point is critical to just about everything that goes on in this kernel, right? So is the idea that I'm going to be very careful not to touch anything that anybody outside the kernel can observe until I've done all the checking I need to do. Is that idea clear? Hope, of course, is we're going to find the capability just fine. Possibly use one. Now, however, let's look at that prepare source cap for a minute, which I think is higher up in this file. So if it's a register, the case is actually pretty easy. Let me go back to the IMG param structure. You notice there's a source cap and a desk cap structure. What's in those? Well, they're the same. The reason actually is that we need to handle them differently, so I wanted them to have different types so the type checker would help me. They have the same fields. Careful. Notice that there's a sleazy trick going on here. If the source of the destination capability is a register, capability register, then I already know that I'm going to have the relevant process locked at the time I go to manipulate this thing. I don't need to make any special copies of that capability. In that case, what's going to happen is that the cap pointer is going to be made to point directly to the register slot. Fortunately, if the capability is a memory capability, you could store it before I get around to using it, but after I validate it. In that case, what has to happen is I have to make a local copy of that capability into this data structure, and I will arrange for the cap pointer to point to the local copy. What's going to happen on the way out is the reverse. So if we look at the Marshall source cap, right, if it's a capability register, it says, okay, look, the way that I could be wrong in the encoding of a capability register, I only have 32. If you ask for number 33, something's not right. You have an excessive number of fingers. If you have 33 fingers and toes, there's too many, right? I mean, it's bad. Assuming that the index is a valid index, which we have to check because the assumption is you're out to play games, what I'm going to do is cache a pointer to the register, and then if you told me to, I'm going to prepare that capability. I add the extra argument. Look, I'm sitting here looking at the capability game. This is a good time to prepare it. About if it's a memory case. I'm going to extract the address. I'm going to validate that the virtual address that you gave me is a valid user mode virtual address. You could be trying to extract a kernel out of the kernel state, a capability out of kernel memory, right? That's not okay. If it is, I'm going to call a helper function. What this function does is it basically finds the slot within the capability page that this address references. And there's a bunch of nasty details about this. This actually executes most of the address translation logic. At the moment, this path is not very efficient. We could cache a lot more of this than we are currently doing in the hardware page tables, and we should. But at the moment, we're not doing that yet. We're still in the stage of get something working. Most days it does. Okay, good. So now we need to actually fetch a copy of this capability. Why? Because capability pages are not under normal circumstances mapped in the kernel at all. What we need to do here is build a temporary mapping, okay, prepare the target, and then make the copy. And it occurs to me, now, why do we know the target's not going to get overwritten? Well, it turns out that the find cat page slot grabs a lock on that page, which we have to hold at least until we've accomplished the copy. We could, by the way, and maybe should, let that lock go down here. We don't currently do so, and that's arguably a bug. It's not a bug in the sense that it will cause any failure of correctness. It's a bug in the sense that it will encourage contention among multiple processors if you have lots of processors sourcing the same page. If we actually observe contention, we'll add more code to deal with it. More code is not your friend. Now, it's also possible to reference the capability through a path that had a weak restriction in it. And if that's the case, we have to respect that. So after the copy, we conditionally weaken the result. Right, that's the downgrade operation. Have I explained the weaken operation? Okay, here's the idea. I have a graph of capability structure that I want you to be able to reference. I do not want you to be able to get any write access through it. For example, I'm managing an address space, and I need to guarantee that your access to that address space is purely read-only. Why? Maybe I want to guarantee that you have to do copy on write. Maybe I want to be able to share that address space, and I need to know that the parties participating in the sharing cannot communicate with each other by modifying the content of the address space. So there's a permission bit in the memory capabilities called the weak bit. And the weak bit rule is, if when you're walking the memory path, you encounter a weak bit, it means that any capability that is fetched through the weak capability must be downgraded, must be weakened. Basically, whatever capability you've got, you downgrade it into a read-only weak variant of whatever you got. So if you started with a read-write page capability, you get a read-only page capability. You started with a read-write capability page capability, you get a read-only weak capability page capability. You start with a GPT capability, read-only weak. If you start with an entry capability, what you get is a null capability. But we do not know what the protocol is of the process on the other end of that entry capability, so we do not know how in the kernel to do a correct read-only restriction. Rather than try to do that, we do the conservative thing of saying we just won't allow that to go anywhere. Not to say there aren't other policies that you might want to implement that might have more knowledge. I'm just saying the kernel is not enough knowledge to implement those policies. So, you know, could be you fetch this capability from a weak region, so we have to downgrade it. Having done so, we can unmap the target capability page because we're done with it. We've copied the capability out of it. A similar deal is later going to happen, and since we're here, I'll anticipate it, is later going to happen marshaling the destination capabilities. In this case, though, it's slightly different. In this case, what has to happen is if it's a register, same deal. The target process by this point is going to be locked down in memory, and we can just copy directly into it. If it's a capability page, things are a little funny. Memory address, things are a little funny. Remember, this is an output parameter. So presumptively, we're going to write a capability to the slot you told us to write, and that target page better be writable. Assuming it's writable, we better mark it dirty. So in the input case, what's happening is we're getting the capabilities. In the output case, what's happening is we're setting up the slots that are going to receive the capabilities. And where in the earlier case, we actually could release our mapping on the page, in this case, we cannot. Notice that there's no transmap unmap. We need that capability page to stay mapped. We can write it later. Marshall Descap is getting called on the way in. They were later going to be stored in these locations, so we have to hang the mappings to them, of course. There's another bit of fine print. Capability register zero is not modifiable. It's guaranteed to hold the null capability at all times. So if you told us that you wanted register zero, we're simply going to redirect the store to go to this garbage location called the null target cap. You go look at the comment, right? You'll see that this is a write-only variable. We'll never source this variable. It exists only so that cap set does not have to check for the target pointer being null. Believe it or not, we've just made a surprising amount of progress because you've now seen that, okay, marshaling the source cap is just going to get it for us so we know where it is. And in this case, we've prepared. We haven't prepared it yet. If we are sending capabilities, we better marshal the ones we're going to send so we know where to send them from. And if the other guy is receiving capabilities, which is an open question, then, if we're receiving capabilities, RC does not mean receiving capabilities. Okay. We have not yet even checked what kind of capability we're invoking. But here's the problem. I send you a message. What is it that enables you to reply? Well, it's the fact that I send you a capability on which to reply. And there are two ways we could go about doing that. We could build a session full protocol, or we could build a remote procedure style protocol. There's nothing in the kernel that tells you which protocol you should build. It's got enough mechanism to build either one. As a matter of preferred idiom, we tend to prefer the remote procedure call model. This is one in which I call you and I tell you every time where you should respond. The session full model would be, I phone you up and say, we're going to do a long-term communication, and let me give you a capability when you're sending a message back to me, here's where it should go, so that you now, once I get around to actually sending you content full messages, you know in advance where the response should go. Anybody want to speculate why we tend not to prefer the session full approach? Why would sending you a reply capability in advance be a bad idea? Or what cost might it carry? A good idea, it might improve performance, which would be the argument in favor.
You can just store those.
To store that capability somewhere. And that's fine if you and I have an exclusive monogamous relationship. For the record, none of us have an exclusive, I don't have an exclusive monogamous relationship with any of you, a statement for which I'm vaguely thankful. Group's like, oh man, where is that big pile of dew? Because he's trying to step in it. So the problem is you've got to store this thing. Now, if I'm your only client, that storage probably doesn't matter much. But if you're a service that responds to multiple parties, there's a problem that now you've not only got to keep track of the capability, but when I call you back the second time, you have to have some way to associate me with the capability that you've previously stored. And that's extra work. So at the cost of copying the capability redundantly on every call, I avoid the extra work. There's a second cost, though, that's a little more subtle. Suppose I'm a client, I'm talking to 15 different services for various things. One of them provides network, another one provides a file system, another one provides something else. I probably do not want the network replying to my invocations of the file system. And guess what? People who code network stacks make mistakes. It comes as a big surprise to me that they do. People who code file systems also make mistakes. Anybody who runs Linux already knows that. Anybody who runs Windows really already knows that. One of the things I would sort of like is to say, look, when I call you and you respond to me, we're done. If you screw up after that, I'm not going to hear about it. I want the protocol to be over. I mean, I want it to be over with an exclamation mark, right? No possibility that you'll call me up again. So one of the things that we would like is a way to say, look, when that invocation that is the reply happens, the act of replying causes the authority to reply to cease to exist. What we want is an invoke once capability. Now, if we're going to have an invoke once capability, then I need to give you a new one every time I call you. So what the RC bit says is, here's the protocol. And unfortunately, the kernel has to sort of know which slots are involved for reasons of efficiency. The RC bit says, OK, I have placed an endpoint capability in slot 0, capability slot 0 of the message. on the way through, I would like the kernel to rewrite that capability as an entry capability. Mostly, that's simply rewriting the type field. The other part of it is that it has to pick up the protected payload value from the endpoint and copy it to the entry capability. Why? Well, there's a bit in the endpoint capability called the payload match bit. A half of the set. The second field holds the protected payload. I'm sorry for writing too small. I didn't write the object large enough. The payload match bit is set. And when you invoke the entry capability, the protected payload and the entry capability is compared to the protected payload and the endpoint. If they do not match, it is not valid. It will behave in all respects as if the entry capability will behave in all respects as if you had invoked a null capability. If it does match, then the one at the endpoint will be incremented to guarantee that it will never match again after the invocation is successfully completed. Because, of course, we might have to back out after this check is done, so we don't want to do this too early. That has the effect of guaranteeing that every remote procedure call will receive at most one reply. It could receive zero, because maybe you don't answer, but at most one. So the RC bit here is saying, yes, we'd actually like to do that protocol. Now, in order to do that protocol, all of a sudden it matters what source cap zero holds. We have to prepare it because we have to get the target endpoint. Now, assuming that preparing it succeeds, that means we know what this capability is and we know that its target is in memory. What does it mean we know what this capability is? It means whatever capability it was, cap prepare has done the right thing, but that doesn't mean we know what it is. Now we've got to check. We're going to do this substitution if and only if the capability supplied in slot 0 is still an endpoint capability. Why do I say is still an endpoint capability? Well, first, you could have just handed me the wrong capability. You give me an endpoint capability, you don't get an entry capability. So sorry. And second, it could be that you handed me an endpoint capability to an endpoint that has been revoked. If that occurs, the active preparation will cause it to be rewritten as a null capability. And then it's as if you never handed it the endpoint capability in the first place. Notice that this is not the same endpoint as the one I'm invoking. This is the endpoint that I want B to use to reply back to me. This has nothing to do with getting there. This has to do with returning. I'm setting up a round-trip ticket. I'm hoping it doesn't get canceled. Okay. Now, if it's an endpoint capability, now there's a catch. Remember I said that if the from argument was a register, I had a pointer directly into the register because I'm trying to avoid copies that I might not need to do? Well, oh boy, here I am rewriting the register. Can't do that because you still want your endpoint capability. So at this point, what I have to do is exploit the fact that I know what the source marshaling logic was doing, and I'm basically going to rewrite this as if it had been a memory capability all along. I'm going to make the internal copy at this point, and I can bung the copy, not rewrite that endpoint capability in place. Rewrite the one in the message. Now, what am I doing when I rewrite that? Well, actually, what I'm doing here is I'm copying the endpoint capability into this temporary location. I haven't actually rewritten it yet. What about the rewriting? Basically, I'm going to go grab the target endpoint, extract its protected payload value, copy it into this capability that's getting transferred, and then I'm going to clobber the type code so that this is now an entry capability. That's the rewrite. That's it. Okay, so much for the reply capability. Now, what about strings? Well, it would be really good to know that the string was valid. There's a limit on how many bytes you can send. Anybody can speculate why? And hopefully you can't send more than your total virtual address space. That seems like an obvious upper bound and not one that one would argue about too long. Why might I want a tighter bound than that? Mach, which some of you know is my favorite microkernel, does not have such a bound. It wouldn't be altogether healthy to attempt to copy more bytes than you have memory. It would happen if you did that. When's the last time you copied the content of your entire disk drive? How much was that? You really would like this to be a non-interruptible operation. But there's a limit to how many years we want to wait. In fact, we're not going to get away with making this non-interruptible operation, which is a problem. So there's a design bound at the moment that says, sorry, maximum string is 64K because I'm not willing to halt the scheduler longer than that. In fact, we're about to have to introduce indirect strings and we're going to have to introduce more process states so that you can pause the build. Well, what about the receive bound? Guess what? If you want to receive more than 64K, tough. Right? The assumption is that if you manage to state that you wanted to receive 4 gigabytes, whoever wrote your parameter block didn't know what they were doing, and we should signal an error. Notice we've not actually checked that these strings are valid. We're just doing length checks. We're doing sanity checks. Rule, never accept the parameter until you've ensured that it's in range. The number of pieces of code that accept parameters between 1 and 3 and don't actually check, and then use them to index some array, boggles the mind. It's probably more common than actually checking. Okay, so it's malformed if you didn't respect the bounds. Now, if you did give me a bound on the receive, I have to know the receiver has specified a bound that is a valid user mode address. Because I'm doing these accesses from kernel mode. The kernel mode cannot protect itself from the supervisor bit. Okay, now, so good, I've done the bounds check. Now, is there a string to send? Well, if there is, then SLAN is non-zero, and now I'm going to validate the receive region. Notice a curiosity here. If the receiver specifies a receive area that's malformed, it will get a fault even if I'm not actually sending any bytes. The principle here is the range checks are part of the initial validation process, right? They should happen at entry to the system call. Whether I then send you something or not, I should. Your system call should be well formed with legal values in all locations. Unless you've said, I'm not interested in accepting a string, in which case those values are not deemed to have any significance. And you explicitly said, I don't care. Now, finally, we don't even know yet if we're invoking another process, right? But now we validate the parameter. We've got to figure out what we're going to do. We have not, by the way, fully copied in the parameter block. We're going to see that coming true. But at this point, it's time to figure out what the hell I'm doing, other than invalidating parameters, which wasn't really the goal. Okay. Hopefully there was more to it than that. At this point, I am going to prepare the capability that is being invoked. Because I want to know what it points to, and for that matter, if it points to. And there's enough funny logic in the prepare for invocation case that we actually bury it off in a separate procedure. So this call is not only going to prepare the immediate capability, but if it's an endpoint capability that's still valid after we prepare it, we're going to go ahead and prepare the recipient capability. I should actually walk into this code. Unfortunately, this may have ended up in current cap, which is not where it belongs. I think it's in here. Because all the prepare logic was in here, so. Now, okay, so cap, prep, and lock, right? If you prepare a capability and it's not your capability, target gets locked. So that's actually the bottom layer of the prepare. Well, okay, if I do not get back an object header from that, then either this wasn't an object capability or it wasn't a valid object capability and I'm done. By the way, if it wasn't an object capability, then obviously it doesn't point to an endpoint. So I'm going to return a null pointer. The fact that I get back a null pointer tells me already there's no endpoint, so I can't be doing a process, cross-process invocation. In which case, I'm going to do the other path, which we won't get to today. All right. Give me an object capability, but not an entry capability. Again, I'm not doing a cross-process invocation. We're done. Well, now I know it's an entry capability, and I know it's valid, so I know there's an endpoint. How do I know it's valid? I've already prepared it. If there's an endpoint, the protected payload doesn't match. And wasn't really an entry capability after all. The payload didn't match. And the statement is it's going to behave exactly like a null capability. Notice the cap in it that initializes the capability to null. Notice we just overwrote it, which might be a bug. No, it's not a bug, because if this capability is not valid, it's really okay to nullify it, because it's still going to be just as not valid next time. One of the things we actually work very hard to ensure, is that things ceasing to be valid is a stable condition. It doesn't sort of jump out at you that that would be important, but you'd really like it to be the case that things never magically become valid again. Okay, so good. So now, if I get to 208, then I know I have a valid entry capability. Now I need to worry about whether there is a recipient. So I'm going to pull out that recipient capability and prepare it. And this assert, by the way, is a sanity check. We guarantee in the, there's an endpoint routine that sets the receiver slot. That routine checks that you've either got a process capability or a null capability or it fails. A process capability can turn into a null capability by virtue of the process being destroyed, but there shouldn't be any third case here. Since we know something about the fields, we're checking that it has to match one of these cases. There's a catch. Just because you handed me an entry capability to an endpoint does not mean that the endpoint is a valid receiver. That's one of the cases we talked about last week. Is the case where we're going to build this null stream, and part of the way we're going to block people is we're going to shove them back onto some other endpoint that doesn't allow them to make any progress. We talked about having a process that was never receiving. It turns out that's not necessary. Simply sticking a null capability in the endpoint will do. And you're seeing it right here why that's the case. If there is no valid recipient capability, that is, we don't have a process capability, we're not going to go anywhere. Assuming the sender is willing to wait, what we're going to do is we're going to enqueue them on this endpoint. We're going to do that by this odd header sleep on. Technically speaking, we're not going to enqueue them on this endpoint. We're going to enqueue them on a stall key that's a hash of the object ID of this endpoint. But often we're enqueuing them on this endpoint. So if there's no way to make progress and you're willing to wait, boom, you're going to wait. If you're not willing to wait, that's actually the interesting case. There's a bit of sleazery happening here, if that's a word. It is now. Which is, what if there was somebody to invoke, you're going to end up invoking. If there's nobody to invoke, or if for some reason you might have to wait and you're not willing, we're going to pretend that we didn't find an endpoint by returning null. If we do that, we're going to fall down into the, oh, I'm invoking a kernel capability path. In this very peculiar case, when we go to invoke the kernel capability, we're going to discover that we invoked a kernel entry capability. Notice that the only way we could end up in that path is if we weren't willing to wait. And so contrary to what you might expect, first, you might expect, well, there's no kernel handler for the entry capability as an entry capability because all of those should be cross-process cases. No, there is a handler, and it exists to handle this case. And if, when we look at it, what we're going to discover is it is always just going to return successfully without changing anything. That would not be obvious if we hadn't dug into here. It may not be obvious now, but it certainly wouldn't be obvious if we hadn't dug into here to see this leasy trick going on. And by the way, there definitely needs to be a comment there, and I'm not sure if there is one at the top of the procedure. Definitely got to fix that. I'll call up Jonathan Adams, slap him around a little bit. Okay. Now, the other possibility is it's a valid process capability, because those are the only two possibilities there could be. In which case, we want the target process and we want it nailed down, preferably with a lot of nails. We really do not want it wiggling while we're trying to change its state. Now, of course, that process could not be receiving. Just because you invoke me doesn't mean I'm listening. Right? Sorry, I have a 3-year-old in there. Get something out of it. Just to make real life really fun, I'm making a tacit assumption here. That the invokee is not the invoker. You could contrive an endpoint that points to yourself and invoke it. That is a nonsensical thing. Well, we could take the position that that is a nonsensical thing to do, but it is a nonsensical thing to do that has to have a well-defined and preferably undesirable outcome. Okay, it turns out invoking yourself is a legal thing to do. I don't even want to do it. So, the rule is, actually, in general, it's not. Why? Because at the moment of invocation, you're not going to end up in the receiving state. Right? So I told you early on, the theory of operation here is it's as if I invoked some other process that did the operation by magic and then replied to me according to a particular protocol. That means that if I invoke myself, it's as if I sent a message to somebody else, transitioned into the receiving state, and then they got a message back. So I get a chance, logically, to transition into the receiving state. And that's why cell OK matters. I don't think we're currently using self OK at all. I don't remember. I have to go check it. We are using it, but it's not for this case. In fact, we don't allow it. The target process has to be in the receiving state, or the sender will block immediately. So if we were to call ourself, right, this is one of these cases where the theory of operation is not precisely matched by the implementation. Why? First, if you do this, you're a moron. Right? So you deserve to fail. Okay. But aside from personal bias, the problem is that to implement this correctly, we would have to keep a storage area to store a transient copy of the data stream that you might be sending and receiving. Otherwise, we can end up with scrambled eggs if the input pointers and the output pointers overlap. So we would either need to make a transient copy, or we would need to expose the semantics of the copy as overlapping and allow scrambled eggs as a legal outcome. With allowing scrambled eggs as a legal outcome is tricky to specify what the behavior is. And unfortunately, once you allow the behavior and you specify the behavior, there's this thing called backwards compatibility, and the fact that you were an idiot for invoking yourself, regrettably, makes it more likely that you will complain to the support hotline that the operation did not operate as specified. So, we don't do that. Now, what about the self-OK case? Well, just like I generate a reply capability to allow you to reply to me, if I'm invoking a kernel capability, I have to generate a reply capability by which the kernel will reply to me. In that case, that capability will point to me. And at this moment, I will still be in the running state. We have to allow for that here. Rule is, in general, the receiver better be in the receiving state. Except in this other funny case where the kernel's going to be replying to me, and at the time of the reply, I'll be in the receiving state, but I'm not there yet. Now, if I'm not in a valid state, or if the receiver's not in a valid state, and I'm willing to block, the same thing you're doing. Otherwise, notice I return null again, same sleazy trick as before. Okay. Now, the other possibility is the receiver could be in a receiving state, but they could be saying, I'm in a receiving state, but I'm only willing to receive from him, not from you. Okay? Well, again, am I willing to wait or not? Same thing. This code, by the way, is unnecessarily baroque, perhaps even baroquean. That's with a Q. Okay, but good. If the receiver agrees, if they're in the receiving state, and they're willing to listen to me, good. Now I know who the invokee is, and I know what endpoint I'm going through, and I return a pointer to that endpoint. And that's what I needed to know. That's the goal I wanted here. But notice that if there is something that could go wrong, presumptively it might, and we better check. Failure to check is a capital crime. Okay, now, what about this protected payload thing? That crazy block. The rest of this code is actually pretty straightforward. We've now done most of the tricky stuff. If I got an endpoint, then there is an invokee. Why? If there was no invokee, I'm already asleep, or I did not get an endpoint, because the prepared invoke code guaranteed that, at least ensured that. Now, however, now I know there is an invokee, and I had an entry capability, and one of the things that happens when an entry capability gets invoked is its protected payload gets revealed to the recipient. Well, I better get the protected payload, which is what's happening here. Okay? I'm going to fetch it out of the capability that is getting invoked. What the hell? Does not seem right. No, it's fine. Okay. This is... Invokee is doing a closed wait, and they're receiving on, not receiving on me. I'm convinced I can even be in that state here. I think I can't be in that state here. I think prepare for invocation. Okay, we got to review this. Let me skip down to this part, right? So I'm sending capabilities, that doesn't mean they're taking them, right? So if they're accepting capabilities, I have to set up and marshal the destinations so that I can do the copy later, okay? And, if one of the marshals fails and I'm not willing to block, we're done. I'm going to go on to the receive phase. Okay? And the rule here is that, I think this is also a bug. Oh, no, this is not a bug. This is a subtlety. Okay. Okay, the rule is, it is my responsibility to marshal my destination capabilities on the way in. If they're not valid on the way out, it means somebody dinked with my address space. In which case, I don't get a free ride again. So the only case in which this there are several ways in which this marshal could fail. The big one is I'm going to do some object I.O., but in that case, I'm going to block. The other is, it is no longer valid. Well, that could only happen if it was previously valid, because I checked it on the way in on the receiver side. So if it's not valid here, that means somebody changed the game out from under me. Sorry, you don't get to do that. You broke the rules, capabilities will not get delivered. Too bad. Okay. And then, right, if I don't have an endpoint, then the assertion is I don't know who the invokee is, and that would make sense. All right. Now, what about this PP thing? Why am I grabbing the protected payload? Oh, yes, I'm grabbing it for later use. Okay, good. So this check, by the way, is a legacy check. It was we were transitioning here, and I wanted to make sure we got something right. I better be transmitting at least one parameter word. If I don't send you an opcode, it can't possibly be an accurate invocation. What the hell would that mean? Okay, so that's malformed. Well, if I did send you an opcode, right? By the way, that would mean I didn't even have an invocation control word. No, I would have an invocation control word, but no opcode word, right. So if I did, now what I can do is I can figure out what's the send length, what's the first word to be transmitted, first word to be received, and so forth. And there's something very strange here. Can I skip something? But I skip ahead here. So. Yeah. I'm still doing the. This is still the cross-process case. It's just a little tricky. Okay. So what's tricky about this, which is not obvious, is that this is common code. I have to set up the incoming words and the outgoing words and the outgoing parameter length, the incoming send length, regardless of whether I'm going cross-process or local. Right. So previously I was in the if I got an endpoint case. Right, and now I'm validating the input arguments. So what's happening here is this is where I'm copying the input arguments into the kernel version of the parameter block. I'm checking them as I go. Okay, and having done that, what I'm going to do here is call the capability handler for the appropriate capability type, and I've got to figure out how that works. But I think what's going on is if we end up down in the entry capability and we have a valid endpoint, we're going to do the cross-process behavior. Don't hold me to that. In fact, I'm really kind of puzzled by this right now. If I have what's going on here? If I have an endpoint, I got confused by the curly braces. So if I got an endpoint, I'm going to marshal the destination caps. If that fails, I'm going to go to receive phase. If it succeeds, I'm going to dirty the invokee because we're about to start moving state into the receiving process. And that means the process is getting modified. At this point, I'm going to directly do a cross-process copy of the however many parameter words that there were. Right? So they never get copied into the OW fields. Good. And then here, there's some bits of the control word that go across to the receiver. So this is, again, some legacy code that I got to fix. And then I have to report to the receiver how many words they received, and that's some fields that are coming in from the sender that have to get copied across. So there's a set of fields that go into the output parameter word that are taken from the input parameter word. Then I check if there's a string going across. If so, I tell you how much I sent, okay, and I do the send. And the send is done by a cross-process copy that's the world's ugliest code because I'm actually walking the address space of the receiver one page at a time to map those pages. I'm doing the portion of the copy that's appropriate, right, and then letting it go and going on to the next page. Note that on the sender side, I'm not doing that. I'm assuming that the sender's addresses are valid. I could page fault in the middle of this. What happened if I page fault in the middle of this? The crucial thing is I have not updated any state in the receiver. But well, then if I back out, then I'm not going to let the receiver run. If I don't let the receiver run, either the receiver will die and never notice that this happened, or somebody else will invoke them, in which case everything in the receiver that I've modified to this point will get modified again. I'm cheating. Here I actually did modify receiver state, but a modified receiver state that the specification says is explicitly undefined and entitled to move until the receiver's receive phase completes. Why? Because making an extra copy is expensive. All right, so I'm doing the copying, and by the way, this string copy is horribly expensive, which is why we don't like to do them. I could fault in the receiver. If you fault in the receiver, the string copy gets truncated. It is the receiver's responsibility to make sure that the receiving sync area is valid. Don't give me a valid page, and you say, put the data here, and the answer is, I'll go up to the page fault, that's all you get. And we'll tell you it got truncated.
We're copying from the
parameter? No, we're not doing parameter block anymore. We're doing string copy. Okay. This is from the sender to the receiver. It's a cross-space copy for which we have to build a temporary mapping. Right? This is the really expensive case that we were hoping to avoid because cross-space mappings are expensive. Okay. Having done the string, because the string could back out, right? So it turns out you can transfer data without changing the security state of the system. But once you transfer a capability, you've modified the security state of the system. So you can't do any capability motion until all excuses for failing have come to an end. Okay, so, and notice that when we marshaled the receive caps, we nailed those pages down early on. We actually checked them, ensured that they were valid. So once the string transfer succeeds, we know that there are no further possible reasons for failure. And at that point, we'll go ahead and transfer the capabilities. Then having done all of that, we're going to bump the protected payload in the endpoint. And having done that, we're going to report what was the protected payload that was originally in the original entry capability. Why? Well, if this is a reply, the protected payload is being used to guarantee that we don't reply again. And that's where the PM bit comes in. If this is a send, the protected payload is probably being used to encode object permissions that the receiver needs to know. So we transfer it. At least that's the intended use. So that's why this is happening. We transfer the endpoint ID of the endpoint that got invoked. That's how the receiver knows what object got invoked as opposed to what process got invoked. And finally, we mark the send phase as done. And we set the invokee run. Because if our send phase is done, then it follows that their receive phase is done. And we will shortly put them on the run queue, although there's some fine print details that we have to work out there. Now, we've got to be a little careful, because like setPW and setEPID, these have not necessarily changed the recipient state. Fortunately, those values turn out to be among the values that we ran out of registers to hold. So where they went is in some so-called soft registers that's extra space in the process state. And what we next have to do is get them copied out on the receiver side. So what's going to happen here is the invokee run state is going to be PRS running, but because we've arranged to turn off some bits in their control word early on, right? We overwrote the control word. Well, among the things that we did when we overwrite the control word is we overwrote their send phase and receive phase bits with zero, but we left the copy out phase bit alone. So when they start running again, what's going to happen is that they're going to immediately issue their invoke capability system call again. This time they're going to issue it with no send phase and no receive phase, only the copy out phase. So basically what they're going to do is a callback into the kernel that says, now give me the rest of the parameters that you weren't able to get me before. So that last bit of the copy out happens after we're already in the receiver's address space. The question is, good, so the receiver's good to go, now what about me? Am I willing to agree to do a receive phase, or did I say skip that? Well, if I said I'm doing a receive phase, if I'm not doing a receive phase, I go right back on the run queue. If I'm the same as the invokee, which is the case we got to look at, I'm going to return because I've just finished my own receive phase, which is a little perverse. Otherwise, I'm doing a receive phase, and I basically need to... the other guy in the run queue, the question here is who's going to give up the run queue? The other guy in the run queue, and then I'm going to go to my receive phase while I'm going to go to sleep. And then we're in the kernel capability case, which I'm going to skip for now. We'll come back to that next week, but let me get out of the receive phase, because receive phase is actually pretty innocuous. So if there's no invoker, then there is nobody to enter a receive phase. We're done. Otherwise, if I'm still doing receive phase, how could that change? If I were asleep and somebody did a set registers on me, this state could change. I assume that the state is completely stable. But if I'm still doing a receive phase, what am I going to do? Well, basically, I'm going to say, well, if I've made it as far as the receive phase, I must be done with the send phase. That's the first thing. And I'm going to rewrite that back into the caller register set so that if they get woken up and they re-execute the system call, they will not repeat the send. That set PW is doing. Okay. I'm going to change my state to receiving. Okay. Now, the minute I'm receiving, if there are any notices pending for me, I immediately receive them. I don't wait for somebody else to wake me up. Notices take priority over messages. We'll skip over that. If I've just become receiving and you were waiting to send me, I better wake you up so you can send. So that's what the wake all is doing. And the last step is, well, now I'm on a queue, because I'm not on a queue, but I'm not running anymore, so I need to give up the CPU. And I don't want to retry the system call because I've already done everything I want to do. So what I want to do at this point is abandon the transaction. It's a little funny because there were several system calls in sequence here that were boxcarred. So there were actually a couple of transactions that I went through here. It's a little perverse. And if I make it out of the receive phase into the copy out phase, all I'm going to do is copy out the soft parameters. And the only thing that you need to know here is there's no cross-process monkeying around going on in the copy-out phase. So if I page fault in here, that's okay. My page fault handler will get invoked. They'll fix it. I will re-execute the copy-out phase and back up the copy-out. The whole point of doing it on the receiver's dime. If I make it all the way to the end, then I'm done. I can turn off all the bits and the fact that I'm done. And There's a problem in the x86 and the PI syscall done. So some processors, the system call traffic does not advance the program counter. That's good, because that means that if you just tell the process to start again, it will re-execute the system call traffic. Other processors, regrettably including the Hapsium, advance the program counter, but only if you do it with the legacy mechanism. So we actually have to use some logic here to decide whether we're actually done with the system call and we can allow the advanced program counter to remain, or whether we might want to re-execute some part of the system call, in which case we have to back the program counter up again. That's it. We'll go through the kernel case next week. Okay. But hopefully, and I would encourage you to read through this code. It's going to be a short quiz in about 10 minutes. Hopefully, you believe that we checked the entry capability to make sure it was actually an entry capability, we got the endpoint in, we picked up the receiver capability and checked that, and we've hopefully checked all the necessary permission bits along the way. There were a few cases I skipped around and said, oops, what it is. Okay, let us take a 5-minute break. I'd like to get back in by 4. What I'm going to do in the second chunk is take any questions and issues you may have related to the assignment. Because there was a bunch of stuff that came up with that that people are justifiably confused by, and I want to try to respond to that. I also want to apologize. I had promised to get the assignment out Wednesday night. I knew I wasn't going to get it out Thursday night, but I figured I'd get it out Wednesday. I got to the hotel in Dayton, figuring out they'll have an internet connection. Right? It wasn't merely that the internet port in my room was not functional. There was actually no cable going from the internet port to the central telecom room. Just because I checked. And the poor night guy is really trying to be helpful, actually. He was very good spirited, but he wasn't a networking guy. He's not supposed to let me into the telecom closet, but he quickly gets the idea that I know a little bit about networking, so he lets me into the telecom closet. Aha! I see what the problem is. See that hole? There's supposed to be a wire there, and there's no place else that it went, so it's missing. He allowed us out. Hey, he didn't see it either. And then the following morning, the general manager says, yeah, there are 4 or 5 rooms that they seem not to have wired. We're working that out. of course, I was one of the lucky winners. And then the following day, where was I? Well, I was in a secure facility. You're not allowed to hook up to networks there. They really frown on that. I was on airplanes, right? You're not allowed to send packets around on airplanes. I don't know. Like, they don't like that. By the time I was home, it was midnight. So I apologize that it didn't get out earlier. I really was hoping to get it out in time for you guys to go hassle Scott, but it didn't quite work that way. So let's take a 5-minute break, and let's come back, and you can hassle me instead of Scott, which is, if nothing else, at least more fun.